Yeah, it sounded okay to me. I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing today, so I don't know what that's about, but
Your hearing aids, maybe?
no.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of You're on Mute with me, Pastor Elise, and my dear, dear mom who turns 69 tomorrow,
I
Pastor
do.
Mary.
I
Oh,
gotta
my
tell you, I had the
goodness.
funnest day. Seems like everybody thought I was turning 70, but that was okay. I think because I kept saying, I can't wait to turn 70. Anyway,
Mistake number one.
so the pre my preschoolers, at least 60 of them anyway, had a birthday party for me at noon.
Adorable.
Adorable.
Oh my
And
goodness.
I got lots of happy birthdays, and their classes had made me cards, and they had balloons,
No.
and they had a cake. And I took a picture with each class. They almost knocked me over a couple of times,
She's
trying to all,
69, children.
I
Come
know,
on.
trying to all hug me at once. I mean,
Oh.
I did suddenly feel old when all of the much younger teachers were like, "Don't hurt Pastor Mary. Don't knock her over."
Easy now. Easy now, children.
Easy
Easy
now.
now.
She'd be fragile.
She still has all her hips. Let's keep it
I
that
know
way.
exactly.
My
But then my
goodness.
older ladies in Bible study had a party for me too. So I
And
had two
to
cakes.
them, they're probably, you're the youngin'. For
Yeah,
some of
kind
them, yeah. Wow, I remember back when I turned 69.
of. 30 years ago.
30 years ago. Man, what a
Literally
full
one woman,
circle day. What a full circle
literally one
day.
woman could have said that. She's
Yeah.
going to be 100 in September.
Good Lord. God bless. Man, get to
Yeah.
100. Yeesh.
So anyway, it was a busy day, and then I met up with you online, and we had a very wonderful, wonderful conversation with our guest for today,
Man.
Rabbi Lizzie Heidemann, who is the founding rabbi at Mishkan Synagogue in Chicago. And so you're going to hear some about her story. And as is true for pretty much every rabbi I've ever encountered, she has such high intellect and such a wonderful ability to make an argument and to teach and to tell you all kinds of things. So, it was a very full time of conversation with her. We're very certain that some of the things that we talked about will be of interest to you. Just learning a little bit more about what Judaism is, how to understand it, because we feel like so many Christians don't, especially those that don't live in, rural urban areas where there tends to be a higher Jewish community. And so we assume, maybe incorrectly, that a lot of our listeners don't really have like friends who are Jewish. Some may have family members who are Jewish, but it's kind of few and far between. We don't have neighboring synagogues for the most part.
I looked up, so I looked up. So one of my members suggested we do like a Christian Seder, which I have very strong negative feelings
Feelings
about that.
against.
And so I said we can certainly create some kind of interfaith dialogue, and we can invite our Jewish neighbors to come and talk to us about Passover dinner and, the links between our two belief systems, because I remind, my folks a lot. We in a lot of ways are a branch of Judaism. Like we are a lot of our central moral ethic, whatever ethical faith-based traditions are stem from Jewish reform. Like
Well, they are
Jesus was
our
a
faith
Jew.
ancestors,
They are our faith
our faith
ancestors.
ancestors.
And so I started to do a little bit of research on where the closest, I'm most familiar with the Reformed movement of Judaism, and so I was looking for a Reformed synagogue. The closest one is 2.5 hours away.
Yeah, I believe it.
And I was just like, well, and there goes that. So I was kind of bummed. But
guess we'll have to Zoom.
Guess we'll have to Zoom it. Yeah. But no, Rabbi Lizzie is phenomenal. And I think she's the first guest we've had that has kept both of us completely quiet for long stretches of time. I mean, just I even told her in the middle of our conversation, I said, I could listen to you teach all day. Like she really clearly has a teacher's heart and explains so much and just beautifully articulates some the answers to our questions. And you know, we talk about kind of the structure of the Jewish faith and what we would call denominations, you know, kind of how that works. We do a lot of like, oh my gosh, that happens with us too, you know, kind of there's some comparison. And then we also do kind of dive into her thoughts on what's going on in with the Israel-Palestine conflict currently. She lays out some really beautiful history that I think will be great for people to know. And you know, it's a bummer. We were having so much fun talking about everything else. And when we really started to dive into that, we kind of ran out of time. So we're hoping to get her back so we can continue that conversation. But you know, I really, this conversation was just so rich and so, you know, just really, really phenomenal. And if you are a regular listener for us, our very good family friends, the Sternfrieds, Gail and Ari and Noah, who we talked to about our different experiences in the Holy Land, they are lucky enough to have Rabbi Lizzie as their rabbi, and is how we learned about her. So we're just so grateful for her time and her mind and her spirit. It was just a really beautiful conversation. I'm excited for you all to hear it.
Yeah, absolutely. So keep listening all the way to the end, even if it takes you 3 days.
That's right. Keep on chipping away. It is worth it.
Away.
Enjoy the conversation, and we will see y'all next time.
Sounds good. All right. Welcome, everybody. We are, Elise and I are so excited today to welcome Rabbi Lizzie Heideman, who is the rabbi at Mishkan Synagogue in Chicago. And how we first got to know her is our good friends, Ari, Gail, and Noah are members of that synagogue and have told us for so long how excited they are to be a part of it and how life-changing it was. And we had, Rabbi Lizzie, we had a great conversation after the trip that you took to Israel-Palestine and took them and other people from your synagogue. And then Elise and I happened to go that fall. You were there in the summer, right?
Yes.
Yes. And then Elise and I went on a trip that fall. And so it was really cool when we all got together at Christmas, which is what we've been doing for almost 30 years. when we got together at Christmas and started sharing our experiences, and I could just see how life-changing it was for them. And was just very, very excited for that. But so we wanted to have some conversation today. As I told the rabbi when we started talking about doing this podcast, Elise and I are both located in the Southeast, which is not a highly Jewish area, shall we say.
Not a lot of interfaith action going on around here, unfortunately.
Not a lot of interfaith action happening. But at least, you know, we lived in Chicago for 17 years up in Evanston. But basically, Elise grew up in Evanston.
That is true. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so I learned a lot. I was very involved with my neighboring synagogue in Evanston, Beth Emmett, the Free Synagogue with Peter Noble.
Yeah.
And that was life-changing for me because I'd never had an opportunity to really know any Jewish people. We have Jewish people in Columbia, South Carolina, but I never knew they existed really. And since I've moved back, I've learned differently, of course. So I also realized that, you know, as a Jewish community, you're a minority group in America. And that always puts people in a minority group in an odd position of constantly having to describe who they are, what they're about, and making themselves known. And so on the one hand, I apologize for that. That's exactly what we're going to ask you to do.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I signed up for as a rabbi.
Yeah,
I bet.
True, true. Yeah.
Talk publicly about Judaism.
Yeah.
Right.
Check.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh man. Well, we appreciate it.
Yes.
We do.
Well, so, you know, our podcast of You're on Mute, kind of our little tagline is different generations are differently wise.
Yeah.
So if you would
Beautiful.
start kind of telling us what generation you identify with and what difference that makes in your ministry, that might be good.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. What generation? Because I assume that you're referring to things like the greatest generation, baby boomers, Generation X, millennial, Gen
Correct.
Z, et cetera.
Yeah.
Because we're coming up on Passover, I'm thinking about something Rabbi Harold Schulweis talked about the generations of Jews, like American Jews sitting at the Passover table.
Wow.
And you know, there's like the immigrant generation that like came over at the turn of the, obviously this is reductive because, you know,
Right,
even in
right.
my family, I have the people who came over after World War II from Europe, and I have the people who came at the turn of the century from Eastern Europe, you know, both differently escaping different kinds of anti-Semitism and persecution, but like different contexts.
Yeah.
But he talks about like the generation that came over on the boat in the, you know, early part of the 20th century. And for them, Judaism was a native language. You know, it was like Yiddish was a native language. Practicing was a native language. For their children, it was also a native language, but that they learned it from their parents, and you know, they wore it comfortably, but also were trying hard to assimilate into America.
Right.
And that's like I think about my mom's family, where they were trying really hard to assimilate into American culture. And so Judaism in America became, there was a synagogues in America were trying desperately to imitate Christian churches, you know, taking out the Hebrew, taking out the keeping kosher, make synagogue instead of Saturday being Shabbat, make Shabbat Sabbath Sunday, you know, and just fit in. And then you have their children who reacted against that by feeling like Judaism was completely vapid and meaningless because their parents tried to make it basically, you know, as vanilla as possible. And a lot of those people became Buddhist teachers and became, you know, like went, like left Judaism altogether. And then you have me, like the children of those people who are, you know, roughly, you know, kind of generation number four, who are reclaiming the tradition and kind of trying to mine history and reclaim the stuff that my parents didn't even know existed. And
Wow.
their parents kind of jettisoned because they thought like, ah, who wants to know this stuff anyway? You know, because for them, you know, for them, it was like, hey, who needs this? Who needs the keeping kosher? Who needs, you know, all the stuff that makes us weird in America? And it's like, and my generation, and I think you're seeing this so much, is people are like reclaiming their ancestral weirdness. People are, you know, reclaiming all the things that, you know, make us unique and different, because actually, like, that's what makes us beautiful. And that's interesting and powerful. So, you know, technically, according to the, you know, millennial, what I think I'm an elder millennial. Like, I was born on the last day of 1980. My parents are baby boomers. My parents are baby boomers. And that's very much, I mean, that sort of dovetails, I'm guessing, into the question about, you know, like how did I become a rabbi, and what's the origin story of Mishkan? You know,
well,
all of these things are connected.
And what's really cool about what you said to me is, as Christians in America, I think we're going to get to that point because a lot of our traditions and so forth are just kind of falling to the wayside. Like our Holy Week, like almost nobody comes anymore. You know, like who needs that? We'll come for Easter Sunday and that'll be it. And so that was one of the things that I learned when I was a pastor in Evanston and was around so many Jewish people for the first time. And what I observed was how your community had, you had to, the government would not support your high holy days. It did not support your Sabbath. You had to do that yourselves. And that is where Christians are headed. right? We're going to have to do that ourselves. And it might be a while,
I'll
but we're
say
already starting
in
to see
hundreds
it
of years,
happen.
probably. Well, and we
I
hear
think
that.
it's fascinating. I mean, just to say, like, there's a rabbi named Mordechai Kaplan who wrote about the Jews being in two civilizations, and it's like one civilization is whichever country we live in, and the calendar and the language and all of that, and that's sort of what you're talking about. It's like on the American calendar, Christmas is a national holiday. There's not a school in the country that doesn't take off for Christmas week, and for Jews, that's the day we get on airplanes and fly to Cabo because like it's just empty. It's like we're not sitting around the Christmas tree. But that said, like Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, our like holiest days of the year, often fall on the first day of school, or Shavuot, which is in May, which many progressive Jews aren't even aware is a holiday, but for Orthodox Jews, certain like it's a major holiday. Is often, it could be during finals, it could be the last day of school, it could, and nobody knows about any of this stuff. So, that's kind of the blessing and the challenge of living in two civilizations.
It
It
is.
is.
And there's that phrase too, like that I heard a lot growing up in Evanston, but also in general, of people describing themselves as culturally Jewish, but not religiously Jewish. And I think, to what you were saying a second ago, Mom, I feel like that might be more so where Christianity is headed. I think the idea of Christian nationalism is so ingrained in this country that we're always going to get Christmas off. We're always going to get, this or that. But I think the shift that we're seeing in Christianity is people becoming culturally Christian, where they wear the cross, they have the bless this house sign on the outside, they go to Christmas and Easter, they'd go to the high holy days, but like that's it. But in terms of like practice and recognizing the other religious parts of that culture, that kind of starts to fade away. I think that's where Christianity is probably headed more than anything, but
And
it's
that's,
cool to see
it's
in other.
interesting, even, it's like I'm so culturally and religiously Jewish. So like it's really interesting to sort of hear how those descriptions hit in, to like to your ears. 'Cause when I hear culturally Jewish, what I hear is person who has complicated feelings about God and does not want to be associated with any kind of simplistic belief about God, or does not want to be associated with any kind of like oppressive practice of Judaism, or people who, are coercive or, in any way kind of wield Judaism as maybe, like a tool for authority or God forbid violence or any or exclusion or anything like that. And so they say like, I'm culturally Jewish. What that means is I enjoy meals with my family for Shabbat, Passover, Rosh Hashanah. I might even fast on Yom Kippur. I might even light candles for Shabbat, like on Friday night. And so the truth is, when you start to scratch at the surface for people who say they are culturally Jewish, I really think they're describing quite often a mildly robust religious practice that they just like they don't actually they but they kind of want to be clear, like, but don't associate me with those people who wield religion in oppressive ways. That is not who I am. And I like that's a little bit what Mishkan I was trying to kind of reclaim is like, no, y'all who are spiritual but not religious, reclaim the mantle of like calling yourself religious, because A, we need people who call themselves religious, who are progressive, who want to include LGBTQ people, who want free slaves and captives, and not practice, like we need that. And there's so much crossover also in the, sort of cultural religion. How do you disentangle, Rosh Hashanah dinner from Rosh Hashanah? You're celebrating the new year,
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I
and I think
know
for
people's definitions of things are interesting.
I know. Well, and I think for us, the distancing is, I talk a lot in my sermons and with my folks at Bible study about the difference between like the church, big C and little c, you know, so like the difference between like the institutionalized church and what that has been, kind of the monster that that has become, versus kind of church seen as a community, seen as a religiously driven movement, and kind of the distance, I think, where some of the more progressive Christians are trying to get is, we are not the evangelical church. We are not the like non-denominational church that are kind of these like big box churches that do kind of get looped into harming people and using, weaponizing our scriptures and things like that against other groups. It's like, no. Like, so, 'cause I always say, a lot of people, when they find out I'm a pastor, the first question I get is, really? Like, it's like they don't quite believe it. And then others are like, Lutherans, are they Christian? That's the second question I get, especially in the South. And then it's usually followed up by like, I didn't know women could do that. Or they say, but you cuss and you're like, and you're open to like other beliefs and you're open to like other
Oh,
ways.
that's
Like,
work.
I didn't realize that was a thing Christians could be. So I typically say, like, I'm a Christian, but I'm not an asshole, is usually
That's good. That's good. You
where
should put that on a bumper sticker and sell it.
I know, right? Exactly.
Wow.
But I think people would love to hear more of your story and kind of the creation, this beautiful thing you're forming here in Chicago, or there in
That's
Chicago.
nice. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I'm so honored that the family that sent you to me, the Sternfried family, came on that trip and joined our community. I feel like when I meet quality people in our community, it makes me feel like our community is doing its job.
Totally,
Because the people who show up that I want to hang out with help me remember, like, this is I created this community to create a circle of people I actually want to spend time with and travel with, and so anyway, I adore them, and I'm sure they'll listen, and hi Ari and Gail and Noah. So my story is, I grew up on the south side of Chicago in Hyde Park. I feel like Evanston and Hyde Park are kind of like mirror images,
They
on either
are.
side of the
Yeah,
city of
I would say they're
Chicago.
mirror images divided by
That's right,
the
exactly. And so you have Northwestern University in Evanston, kind of being the anchor, the intellectual anchor, and so many of the people and, the big houses that are up in that neighborhood are inhabited by professors and people associated with the university. You've got the hospital. And then down in Hyde Park, it's the University of Chicago, and it's the same thing, like big kind of old historic houses and people associated with the university. And I grew up going to a Reform synagogue in Hyde Park, where many of the people I was surrounded by were in fact related in some way to the university. It was a very intellectual place. And most of what I'm going to say, I did not know was unique or special, or that I had anything desirable in that environment growing up. Like, I didn't know that it was unique to have, university professors giving lectures on Sunday mornings while, to other parents while the kids were at Sunday school. I didn't know. Like, I didn't know that it was unique. The guy who was our song leader, who did prayer for the younger kids, and then was the teen leader, the youth advisor for the teenagers, was a PhD student at University of Chicago, who ended up becoming, professor, went to WashU, but is now like leading the reform movement. And I had no idea that that was special or extraordinary. I had a rabbi whose name was Rabbi Arnold Jacob Wolf, may his memory be a blessing, who was this kind of like stout little 5'2", gruff little bearded man, who was kind of at the tail end of his career. This was his last job before he retired. And he was like a social justice beacon. He was constantly 25 years ahead of wherever the reform movement was, talking about civil rights before it was popular, talking about like a two-state solution to, the quandary about once Israel won the 1967 war, like, now what? And the what is give the land to Palestinians to create a state, because otherwise we're going to end up being occupiers. Like, he knew that back in the late 60s, and
Wow.
he, and his
That's
voice
amazing.
was his voice was silenced, you know, because there was such a kind of fervor around, like, no, what we have to do is support. And, you know, we'll talk about Israel later, but like, he was always ahead of his time. And I certainly never knew that. But what that meant for the synagogue was like, the high holidays were standing room only. It was packed. Like, we had a beautiful cantor whose name was Debbie Bard. It was just beautiful. It was like, the music was beautiful. The worship was, you know, a combination of English and Hebrew. But like, I learned enough growing up there that I got very turned on to Judaism. You know, the rabbi was provocative and interesting and smart. And like, I got turned on to a Judaism that was alive. And so, but like, also because, and I think people in the reform movement would say this, even it's a critique, but it's also, you know, it also, like, Shabbat, kashrut, keeping kosher, the practice of mitzvot, the commandments, there's a kind of pick and choose attitude toward all of it. You know, which is to say, because we don't believe in a literal commanding God who wants you to do things the way the Old Testament tells you to, because of course, like, Jews have not observed the Old Testament probably ever the way that it is literally written in what, you know, what Christians call the Old Testament, what we call the Hebrew Bible, or the first five books of Moses. It's always been an interpretive tradition. So Reform Judaism was kind of like, look, you know, like, you don't need to take this literally. Like, you don't want to keep kosher, don't keep kosher. Keep kosher if it's meaningful to you. But what that means is that synagogues often make choices that kind of exclude a lot of the practice from, you know, the person who's attending. And so you get an 18-year-old like me who is like thirsty for religious practice and insight and philosophy. And at a certain point, I felt like I had taken Reform Judaism as far as I could take it in my synagogue, and I needed more. So so I did a gap year program after high school, full year in Israel, which I'd never been to Israel before. And it wasn't a particularly religious program. It was, you know, like working on a kibbutz, learning Hebrew, taking some classes at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, doing a lot of kind of hiking and traveling. And I worked in a chicken coop for a month, you know, like I did a bunch of like,
Elisa's done these things too.
It was great. And I did actually spend a good amount of time learning about, I would say, more Orthodox practice and communities. And I came back to America really like turned on to my tradition and excited about like continuing to pursue it in college. I didn't know, I wouldn't have been able to tell you when I was like starting at Stanford University, like, I will be a rabbi. That's my future. But I think honestly, within 3 months, I knew that.
Wow. Like, I knew that. Yeah.
And I think part of that is because I started to encounter really wonderful female role models, like female rabbinic role models. I never experienced Judaism as oppressive to women, or, you know, I never felt like I had to fight for my place in the synagogue. That wasn't the kind of synagogue I grew up in. Thank God. Like, really, I stand on the shoulders of women who came before me, who really made it so that there was no question. I was president of the youth group, and I spoke in our services, and I gave, you know, sermons and spoke at the high holidays, and you know, I never felt excluded as a woman. And then I got to Stanford, and our Hillel rabbi was a woman. I did an alternative spring break trip to El Salvador with the American Jewish World Service, which is like sort of like a Peace Corps in a way. That trip was, that was like an alternative break for Jewish students to go do humanitarian work in El Salvador. And the rabbi who came on that trip with us was a conservative rabbi. So it was like my first experience with a conservative rabbi. And she was a she. And I think I came back from that trip. That was like like spring break of my freshman year. And I think I knew, like, oh, that's the job I'm going to do. That's my future.
Wow. Yeah. That's so cool.
I think one of the things that's interesting about that part of your story is that you, and here again, this is a generational difference. That you had women who were rabbis and who were leaders in Judaism. You see them, you hear them speak, you see them teach. And in my generation, because our denomination did not ordain women until 1970.
And didn't ordain women of color till 1981.
Ooh, that's,
that's rough.
Wow.
I know. So when I put on my clerical collar in seminary, I was the first woman pastor I had ever seen.
Wow.
That was a weird feeling. So,
Wow.
You know, I've been doing it for 42 years now. And now I have all these great people behind me who, you know, didn't have quite the same struggle. So
No,
I'm
I
sure
mean,
that those women in your life would be very glad to know that they had made such a difference for you. I'm just wondering if, quick side note, because in Judaism, there are sort of like different traditions or denominations, as we might say, because you've talked about Reformed movement and you mentioned conservative. Yeah, I don't know that we've said Orthodox yet, but can you just do a quick, like, one liner, like, how are those different from each other or the same?
So I think the way in which they're the same is all of us are drawing from the same source material. You know, all of us are drawing from, starting with the Hebrew Bible, so the five books of Moses, that what we call the Tanakh. Tanakh stands for Torah, Nevi'im, prophets, Kituvim, writings. So that's the Hebrew Bible. You know, ends with Ezra, Nehemiah. That's our Bible. However, at around the same time that the New Testament was kind of coming into formation and Jesus was preaching, there was a whole group of rabbis that, you know, Jesus was like of an era where lots of rabbis were essentially reclaiming and rewriting the tradition, you know, question and answer, dialogue based, you know, really trying to drill down, what did the Torah mean when it said X, Y, and Z? Because it couldn't have meant what it says on the page. And so whereas, right, the New Testament takes it one direction and like reboots Judaism in one direction. The Judaism that I practice, that is the same source material as, you know, all the other Jews who are drawing from the same well called Judaism, we follow kind of a different trajectory that goes into the Mishnah, the Talmud, and then the kind of responsa literature of what we call like halakha, the Jewish way. The halachic, halakha means the way, but it's essentially like the all of the practices that go along with Jewish observance that came down to us through the Talmud, through the Mishnah, from the Old Testament, at which, of course, look very different from what you will see described in the Old Testament. Passover is a great example. Like, we're coming up on Passover now. We just read this past week that lines from Exodus that describe like the first Passover. And God, you know, and some of it remains the same, like exactly the same. You know, you will eat unleavened bread. Like, yes, we're doing that. In 2 weeks, we're eating matzah. You will not have any leaven in your homes. Like, we're all going to clean for Passover. We're going to like scrub our kitchens and get rid of the pasta and the cereal and the crusty bread. And, you know, for 1 week, not eat leavened products. Like, that is actually straight from the Torah. However, it also says you are going to roast a lamb and put the, like, you know, blood on the lintel, and then no, do
no,
not do that. Don't slaughter a lamb. you know, so a lot of the stuff in the Old Testament that has to do with animal sacrifice, like all of that was replaced when the temple was destroyed by the Romans. And so, you know, Judaism had to reboot itself as a mobile, portable religion designed for diaspora, you know, dispersion, you know, for wherever you go in the world, you take this tradition with you in your suitcase. So all of us share, all Jews, wherever we are in the world, at least share the Old Testament. There are, you know, there are some Jews, you know, and so that, first of all, that is to say there are Jews all over the world. Like, that dispersion, the first one happened in 586 BCE with the Babylonians. And then the second one happened with the Romans in the year 70 CE, like two different times when the Jews who were living in the land of Israel or around in and around Jerusalem were, you know, dispersed, taken away. You know, a lot of the Psalms that describe, you know, sitting in Babylon and, you know, thinking wistfully about the good old days. But some tribes of Israel at that point went to Ethiopia or went to India, and they never got the memo about the Mishnah and the Talmud. You know, like they continued to observe Judaism based on the Old Testament rules that they brought with them. I have a great story about this. A rabbi from Uganda who was in my rabbinical school, and it was like a really big deal that he was able to, you know, finally raise the money from his community and come from Uganda to study at this conservative seminary. I ended up going to seminary in the conservative movement. And he was a brilliant man. He's still, you know, chief rabbi of Uganda, Rabbi Gershon Sizomu. And in their class on halakha, on like modern applied halakha, Jewish law, they started talking about not eating chicken and cheese together. You know, not, you wouldn't, you know, included in the rules of kashrut, not mixing milk and meat. It's not just what it says in the Torah, that you will not see the kid in its mother's milk, meaning you will not cook a lamb shank in lamb milk or a goat's leg in goat milk or, you know, a cow meat in cow milk. You won't do that. But more than that, you won't ever, you know, in the same meal be eating dairy and meat, whatever the meat is, whatever the dairy is.
Yeah.
And he looked up from his page and he said, "I must tell my people." It was like, you know, like because they've been doing it from the Bible, and he was, "I must tell my people."
Yeah.
So anyway, that said, right?
Yeah.
Most Jews in the world can, you know, sort of trace our intellectual lineage, you know, whether it's Sephardic Jews through Spain and North Africa, or Mizrahi Jews, you know, through Iraq, Iran, Yemen, Morocco, or Ashkenazi Jews through Europe. All of us are working with roughly the same Torah, Mishnah, Gemara, Talmud, and the rules that come out of those. And the differences are that people who identify as Orthodox really believe and practice all of the rules as if God personally gave the Torah, and that all of these rules are ongoing expressions of God's will, you know? And like God stopped speaking, importantly, you know, like
after
in terms
that,
of prophecy. Like God's not.
Issues.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, and then you've got the reform movement, which I feel like ideologically is kind of what I described earlier, where it's like, okay, guys, let's be honest. We don't really believe in a God who, you know, has a will for individual people and communities that involves, for example, like, oh, if you eat shrimp, you're a bad person, or, you know, like, like, obviously there are moral laws that all of us should follow to create a moral society, you know, and so many of those laws are, you know, are articulated in the Torah in literal ways. And some of them are articulated in the Torah as ideals to aspire to, but you've got to kind of like dig a little bit at what does it mean. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth does not mean, you know, you knock out my tooth, now I get to punch you in the mouth. It means I get to, you know, if you punch me in the mouth and knock out my teeth, I get financial restitution in the value of the teeth that you punched out, you know, my medical bills, you pay for the pain and suffering you caused me. And if I was a model and now I'm going to like lose out on the work I would have had, you know, because I'm a model and I'm a tooth model, you know, you probably pay me more. Anyway, so all of that is kind of where the, that's like where it gets interesting with Judaism, you know, is like, what does the Torah mean when it says eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, or use honest weights and measures, or tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, justice, justice, you will pursue. Why does it say justice twice? What is it getting at? And, you know, like all of that is explained in the Talmud. And I think the intellectual tradition, all of us claim, you know, we love the debate, the dialogue, the idea that like two Jews, three opinions, you know, like there's not necessarily a right answer. There's just the different ways people may experience or practice something based on their family, based on where they come from, based on the circumstances. And that in the Reform tradition, it's sort of like, and that's great. God is still speaking and we are still practicing and we get to decide how to practice. And then in the conservative movement, which was sort of a reaction to the Reform movement, it was sort of like, yeah, but you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Like, you want to have tradition and change, but manage the change really slowly, cautiously.
Right.
You know, you don't want to give it all away. Yeah, exactly. And I would say, like, those are the three kind of big buckets that often the American Jewish community is kind of broken into. And then within and beyond each one, there's, you know, the Reconstructionist community, a little bit smaller, but that's an outgrowth of kind of like outgrowth of the conservative movement, but really it's its own movement now. You have like secular humanist Judaism, which is, we don't believe in God at all. So stop like making this about some pretend spirit in the sky. You know, this is about like ethical practicing. This is about like ethical, like understanding where we come from.
Those are
from.
Kind of the Unitarians for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The UUs. Yeah. Unitarian
totally,
Universalists.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And then within Orthodoxy, you also have shades too. You've got like modern Orthodoxy. They go to college. They, you know, study science and math and take psychology seriously and, you know, speak whatever language of the country they live in and also, you know, learn in Hebrew Aramaic or, you know, read the Yiddish or read the Arabic or whatever the text language is written in. It's a very intellectually robust. But then you also have like shades of ultra Orthodoxy. And sometimes you'll read about these cases like in the New York school system where like these kids don't even know English. These kids, you know, these 18-year-olds graduating high school don't know how to do basic math because in their high schools, they are only learning Talmud and only doing it in the traditional Hebrew and Aramaic. So they're really, really advanced
like
in one area.
Yeah, the Bible's
their only textbook.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
that's right.
I'm wondering if, thanks for that.
Yeah. Sorry, that was like such a long answer.
That's no, okay. I was literally sitting here like, I could listen to her talk all day.
I know. That's great because like I could talk all day. I could talk all day.
Is what I have loved about rabbis for so long. I love your intellect. I love your ability to spin an argument and explain things. It's just so awesome. So were you the founder of Mishkan?
Yes.
Wow. So tell us about that.
Yeah. That's like mission developer is kind of is what
lingo.
Is in our lingo. Yeah.
Or like church planter. Is that the
same? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, oh gosh. So generationally, when I described earlier, you know, that I'm sort of the generation of people reclaiming the traditions of our ancestors and trying to really like reanimate personally and then communally the Judaism that we know is possible. And that when you read, I don't know, I've like behind me, I've got this bookshelf and on there is Martin Buber's Hasidic tales or tales of the Hasidim, like the, you know, the tales of the ecstatic, God-obsessed, singing, dancing communities of Eastern Europe. Like we have these stories of people who are just, you know, like God intoxicated and, you know, couldn't help themselves but live like exceedingly moral and generous and inspiring lives. And then we're like, why isn't that happening in my synagogue? You know, like, why are like these stories about the rabbis who couldn't, like, they couldn't help themselves from getting up and dancing during the service. And then it's like, why are we all sitting with our hands folded in our laps? And the rabbi's saying, now rise. We now we sit, now rise.
Hey, we're with you. We're there. I know.
So even like in the 1950s, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who's like a, you know, great mind and thinker. In the Jewish canon, right? He came from that dynasty, from that lineage of Eastern European rabbis, inheritors of that kind of ecstatic tradition. And he came to America and he looked around. And even in the 50s, he was just kind of aghast at the spiritual malaise, the spiritual vapidity of synagogues. And, you know, and not that the rabbis weren't very smart and very scholarly, but it just like, where was the spirit? Where was the soul? Where was the life? Where was the surprise?
Right.
You know, where were the tears? Where was the feeling? You know, it was just, and so he just wrote scathingly about that. And so, you know, he was critiquing the suburban synagogue as it developed, you know, in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, these large kind of behemoth places. By the time, and they were full. At the time he was writing, those places were full of Jews. They were building these large buildings because there was just this influx of, you know, Jews from you know, moving from urban centers to the suburbs and whatever. And so by the time I was growing up, I mean, I grew up in the city and I grew up in one of those, you know, like a thriving synagogue in the city. However, by the time I was in my late 20s and getting ordained from rabbinical school, Most of those places were in decline. And even the synagogue in which I grew up was in decline. It was no longer full at the high holidays. It was not standing room only. Synagogues were shrinking and merging and, are having a hard time finding and hiring rabbis. I listened to your episode on the pipeline issue. We have that in the Jewish community too, in the liberal Jewish community. And so there was just this feeling of where are the young people and why aren't the young people coming to services and why aren't the young people coming to synagogue? And some of that has to do with pure demography, like pure demographics. Young people are getting married later, so they're not having children as, they're waiting to get married, waiting to have children, and waiting to move out to the suburbs where your synagogue's located, and that, they'll get there when they get there, but it's slower. But some of that is also like people are voting with their feet. You know, people are saying like the thing that the synagogue offers is not a thing that I want. So I was 29. I was a newly ordained rabbi. I was in LA at a synagogue called Ikar, Ikar, which in Hebrew means the essence. And it had been started at that point, I think it was 7 or 8 years earlier, by Rabbi Sharon Brous, who I say her name here, A, because she's my teacher, and B, because, your listeners should go read anything she's ever written or listen to any sermon she's ever given. She's very much like kind of a darling of the Democratic Party. She spoke at the DNC. She offered a prayer this year at the Democratic National Convention. She led a Passover Seder under Joe Biden. So anyway, like I got to be an intern and then a baby rabbi at Ikar. And they were a newly formed synagogue around a vision-driven synagogue. Like imagine that. And it wasn't just about perpetuating the forms and norms and practices of, Judaism that came before us. It was about reinventing and breathing new life into the tradition. And in their case, it was really about like meeting at the intersection of social justice and serious Jewish practice. And anyway, that was kind of the well that I was drinking at, but it was in LA. And like a thing happens, I'm not sure that it happens to everyone, but it does happen to a lot of people I know, which is you're in your late 20s and suddenly like a homing device kicks into your lower brain that says, go home. You know, go home. Maybe it's like Abrahamic, go
Maybe it
to
is.
right. Like I left home to go explore and, do all my spiritual kind of growing. And then I needed to come back to the, back to my native land, so to speak, to Chicago. And when I looked around at jobs that I might want to have as a rabbi, I did not see any that appealed to me as a young adult, as a queer, as a like queer young adult, as a person who was progressive, as a person who, in many ways is like an inheritor of my own rabbi, Rabbi Wolf, like wanting to see Israel make choices that were different than the choices I was seeing Israel make, and wanting to talk about that openly and not be told that I was a traitor to my people or to, Israel, but actually be in a community that not just tolerated, but, invited serious discourse about, what is our role as Jewish people in the world, in Israel, here in Chicago, and was like a robust Jewish space, an inspiring Jewish space where people really learned about what the tradition had to offer and did not feel like Judaism light. So that place didn't exist. So I started talking to people about, what if it did and what would it take for you to show up, and just slowly, slowly I built a little email list and I got a couple, phone numbers of people who wanted to like help create such a thing. And a couple of them were like guys in their late 50s who, were like, oh, I always wanted Judaism to be like what you're talking about. Like, sign me up, use my house, use my house,
No, this is great.
and it really, it was inspired by the biblical idea of the Mishkan, the traveling tabernacle, which the Torah describes as a community building project in which everyone gave what they uniquely could give. And so like the guy who had the big house with the living room, Thank you. We need a big house with a living room to hold a big
Right.
service.
We
And
just don't need to own one.
certainly not right now. That's right.
Exactly.
Et cetera, there was a 23-year-old grad student at the University of Chicago who had done his conversion to Judaism in Los Angeles at Ikar with me. So
Oh,
I had been
gosh.
like his sponsoring rabbi, and he moved to
Oh.
Chicago to do a grad program at U of C, who became kind of like my intern, because like I needed, like, this was all very seat of my pants and, my budget, what I could afford from my own bank account, which it wasn't much, whoever was hosting Friday night would also pay for dinner for the 70 people that showed up or the 100 people that showed up. So that was really nice at the beginning, but then also it's like, how do we expect that of hosts? So we needed to figure out, like, we started applying for grants. I was a young adult. I was, able and eligible to apply for certain young adult grants that, like, I could not apply for now. I'm too old. But at the time, attracting young adults back into Jewish space was a very sexy kind of proposition for philanthropies. So I got a couple early grants from a couple philanthropies that wanted to see Chicago get on the map in terms of, young adult engagement in Judaism. And so that was 2011. And I mean, I was lucky, and I think we were lucky because one of those grants was predicated on, they said, like, we'll give you $10,000, which, by the way, would have just paid myself back for buying the speaker system and the microphone and the, copies I'd made of, anyway, they said, we'd give you $10,000. However, you have to work with this startup accelerator, a Jewish startup accelerator called Upstart, and they will help you put together a business plan and think about, your hiring trajectory and, what your plan is for the next 5 years, like stuff I'd never thought of. And it was so
Which is
valuable.
why they are there.
Yeah,
That's right.
right.
Because, what I learned very quickly was the first person who needs to be hired is not the rabbi. It's the person who's going to, like, keep the trains running and, build a bank account and file our IRS papers and,
It's the
write grants.
administrator. Yeah,
That's
the
right.
administrator, yeah.
Exactly. And so once we had like a stable financial foundation, then I could quit my day job and come to Mishkan full time. And that was early 2013.
Wowzers. Is
That's
there any
awesome.
kind of structural support within like the Jewish denominations? Because like for us, we have, at least in the Lutheran ELCA world, we have like mission developers, and they can go and do like a 6-week course on mission development, and there's certain funds available depending on the synod and the situation. And
But it's
because I
usually for
mean,
like 3 years.
yeah, like they're supported for 3 years, and then it's kind of like you're on your own, kid. And I did my internship out in Bend, Oregon, and a good friend that I made out there, she was a mission developer, kind of forming this new kind of Christian community. And she called it the dwelling. And so I'm getting like real Erica Speight vibes here. I feel like
Funny.
you two would be like BFFs, but so, it's just kind of, we have a little bit of that, not enough, because just like you were saying, big issue in Christianity across the board, but especially mainline Protestantism, is that lack of young people that is just terrifying everyone who grew up and raised their kids in the church, and their kids aren't coming and their grandkids aren't coming, and there's this absolute panic. And so there is, like, if you can come up with this idea that seems very, like it'll attract, young families, especially. Everybody's like, forget young adults. Unless you're reproducing, we don't want to see you in our, like
I
that's kind of
know.
the
That's a
attitude that we
problem.
hear a lot. But so it's interesting to hear it, and I'm just curious if there's any structure, or if you really were just kind of like doing it yourself.
The Jewish community is fairly diffuse. Like, we don't have a pope, we don't have a centralized, like a centralized body that dictates on behalf of the whole religion. Even the bodies that, make proclamations or policy for the movements, the reform movement, the conservative movement, modern Orthodox, different kinds of Orthodox setting, even those people only kind of half listen to, like we're Yeah, there it's like it's all suggestions, but I made the decision to have Mishka not be part of a movement. I didn't want to be beholden to the reform movement's policies about this or that, or the conservative movement's policies about this or that. It constrains who you can hire. It, you know, there are certain constraints that it puts on you. There are advantages to be part of being part of the movements, but I wanted to be independent. So if the movements have something like what you're describing, you know, like church planting seed money, we certainly didn't get anything from any of the movements. What I will say is there are philanthropies in every city, you know, like so any major city is going to have the group of, you know, philanthropists, like you know, it's usually families that are local, they're Jewish families. And very often they also care about other things. They care about medical research. They care about science. They care about education. And Jewish giving is one of their areas, you know? And so that was what we benefited from. And in the case of Chicago, there's an ecosystem of philanthropy. You know, the program officers talk to each other and they say, have you met this person? They're doing something interesting. They'll talk to each other and, you know, figure out like how to distribute, you know, among the different philanthropies to make sure, you know, that people doing interesting work are ideally getting funded. And then there's also the Jewish Federation. Jewish federations also kind of cropped up in cities about 100 years ago, in some cases more, to be kind of to like serve the needs of mostly indigent Jews that were coming over, you know, coming over from Europe very often. Right. And like the YMCA wouldn't serve them, and they couldn't get a house, they couldn't get a boarding room at, you know, this or that home, or do vocational services or job training, whatever. Couldn't go to the local hospital. And so the federations of most cities became like giving ways to both give money and then also distribute money to agencies that would help poor, you know, poor Jews and sick Jews and Jews looking for work and, you know, all of that kind of stuff in cities. And so now, you know, fast forward a couple generations where like that's not an issue anymore. And Jews, you know, especially with white skin, have kind of been, you know, adopted into, you know, the mainstream culture. So now a lot of those federation systems have adapted to, you know, fund innovation or to fund the agency, you know, the JCC system or, you know, the local hospital or whatever it is. In Illinois, the Federation does a lot of funding of like social service organizations, the ones that at first were, you know, designed to serve Jews and now serve whomever, whoever needs help. And so, yeah, Mishkan has been on the receiving end of grants, like specific grants from Federation, from local philanthropies. And our goal, our real goal is to be fully community funded because what that means, of course, at the end of the day is, you know, you don't get broken if a grant or if a philanthropy doesn't give you a big grant and then you have to, you know, God forbid, let go of staff or close programs. It's really nice to be funded from the inside, funded by our own community. But we're only 14 years old at this point. And, you know, what a lot of the sort of legacy organizations, legacy synagogues have going for them is they've been around for over 100 years in a Chicago, you know, Chicago has, you know, been a city, you know, since the mid-1800s, and there have been Jews here for almost as long. And, you know, and so some of the synagogues are quite old. I grew up in one of the oldest synagogues, actually. It was called KAM, Isaiah Israel, and the KAM stood for Kehilat Anshe Ma'arav, which means the community of men of the West.
Wow.
Like, so
talk about legacy, my goodness.
Exactly. So anyway, a lot of those places have endowments, you know, they thought ahead 50 years ago and they built endowments for themselves. And we have nothing like that. So like Mishkan's big aspiration is less getting a building and more like making an endowment.
Yeah, go ahead, Elise.
I was going to say, would you say that now that you're kind of, I mean, this is from an outsider's perspective looking in, but like finding success, right? Like attracting these members and doing some really good work. Do you find that the kind of mainline denomination, so to speak, are kind of knocking on your door now? Like, hey, want to come hang out in this area? Like, can we claim you kind of? Or like, you know?
Yeah. Like, yes, and, you know, I mean, I feel I owe a great debt to the reform movement for everything it gave me in raising me. And I will talk about that openly. I owe a great debt to the conservative movement for training me, you know, that's where I went to school. And in neither case is MishKan a typical reform movement or conservative movement synagogue. Like we're not, you know, we're, if you are expecting reform Judaism and you walk into a MishKan Friday night service, it is an hour and a half long. It is all in Hebrew, you know, the tunes you won't recognize. And you'll say, this is not reform Judaism, you know? Right. One of the main reasons I left the conservative movement is because as open as the movement is to change and adapting to modern times, the movement still does not permit rabbis to do weddings, to perform wedding ceremonies between Jews and non-Jews. You know, 75% of non-Orthodox Jews in America are marrying people who aren't Jewish. Like, that's my community. Those are my people. I'm going to do your weddings. I love you. Right? Come and be part of my synagogue.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, we wouldn't even be permitted in the conservative movement.
Exactly.
That said, I have spoken at and done services at conservative movement, like conclaves, conferences, you know, and also reform movement, and also, you know, like spoken at different rabbinical schools and stuff like that, because, you know, there is this big question, just to your point earlier, like, how do you get the young people in the door?
Right.
And so, you know, like, some of these strategies don't rely on movements. It's, you know, just good practice. Well, you know, like, do you have any young people on your staff? Are the young people on your staff hanging out with other young people?
Those are exactly the questions that new pastors in our church ask as well. Like, so you don't have any Gen X people on your staff?
Or like, you want to draw in families, but you don't have a nursery? Like, maybe build, you know, it's like, I'm a big believer in if you build it, they will come. Yeah. And so, you know, cause that's, you know, I recently changed calls. I was in Chattanooga for 4 years and have now been in Southwest Virginia for the past year. Yeah. And in my interviewing process, everyone that I got that question from, like, the 10 congregations I talked to was, how do you, like, what is your strategy in attracting young people back to church and this and that? And I said, well, the one thing I've got going for me is I'm under 40. And like, for the little bit of time I have left under 40, like, people will automatically come to whatever church I'm at, sometimes just out of pure curiosity, because I'm young, I'm a woman, and I'm liberal. And I just also happen to be a pastor. And so that draws some people in. But I said, but honestly, if you are building a good community that is based on, like, love and morals and things that we can all agree on, and you show an openness and an acceptance, people will find out and people will be drawn to it. There's no, like, magic bullet that, you know, all of a sudden, like, some signal gets sent out and something in somebody's brain goes, I should go to St. John Lutheran. You know, there's, like, nothing that doesn't happen. And so, but I'm like,
other
but if so
building relationships, if there's any magic bullet, that's it.
Yeah. Know? It's like, but if somebody comes into our building, I don't care how old they are. Cause the community I'm in is very small and it's very rural and it's very much a retirement community. The young families who live here typically grew up here. And they already have their churches. So the new people to the community are folks who are newly retired and whatever. So I've pretty much just said, all right, well, I'm going to cater to the retired people and, you know, also create space for families when we get them. We have, like, two or three families right now that have school age kids. And, you know, we do as much programming as we can for them. But I'm like, my Bible studies are going to be in the middle of the day because none of you want to drive at night. And, you know, it's like what you were talking about earlier. It all boils down to, like, the demographic of what surrounds, you know, your centralized place. And so it's like, you just kind of have to cater it. But anyway, I'm getting off our topic.
I wanted to say, Rabbi Lizzie, that, you know, one of the things that, I have heard about MishKan is that, I guess, a couple of things. One, it's very inclusive. of all people, and it's very progressive. And which all sounds like, oh, you know, we're all of the same mind, right? And but that's not true. And
No.
my understanding is that, you know, one of the places that Mishkan experienced that was after October 7th in Israel, Gaza, and that people were of different minds about that. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that a little bit and talk about the maybe some of the things that people agreed on and did not agree on. And the other thing that I had said to you earlier that I really feel like you need to explain to everyone is the difference between Jews and Israelis and those that those terms.
And
Have
when you,
at
that's great. When you
it.
sent me that question, I kind of like my eyes opened wide. Like, are there really people who don't know the difference? And I thought, what a wonderful opportunity for me to speak to
Yes,
that.
right. Lay it on them because there are.
Wow. So,
There are people that didn't realize Jesus was Jewish.
that too.
I have to like make that point sometimes. So that's kind of where we are in some places.
Okay. So, you know how earlier I described the diasporas, you know, the dispersing of the Jewish people, you know, both after the Babylonian conquest and after the Roman conquest. I know this is like, it feels like ancient history, but the result of those conquests and those dispersions was, especially after the one in 70 CE, Jews ended up all over the world.
Right.
Okay. So we ended up all
And
over the
we
world.
are, Christians are familiar with those two dates. We're familiar with the Babylonian exile and the Roman conquest in
If
70.
they're having good Bible studies, they are.
If they're
I'm just
having good
saying.
Bible studies, yes.
And so, you know, and I described to you the kind of the Judaism that was created to respond to that sort of crisis, because of course Judaism had been a tradition focused around a location and around a sacrificial, you know, system in a
Temple.
temple in Jerusalem. And so all of that is destroyed. And it seems like a crisis moment where either this religion disappears or is reborn. And so in the rebirth of Judaism, you know, now what we call rabbinic Judaism, this is sort of the outgrowth of the Pharisaic tradition, you know, these guys who argued about how do we practice this tradition. And one of the things they built into the tradition to, you know, for Jews to tuck into our suitcases wherever we went in the world was turning back to Jerusalem 3 times a day in prayer and praying for the restoration of the temple and praying to one day return to, you know, this homeland. And praying that the line of David, you know, the seed of David one day be restored. So basically praying for the messianic era, praying for a return to you know, our homeland, and praying for the restoration of righteous judges and elders, at 3 times a day, turning east, turning toward Jerusalem, and praying for all of these things, and also praying for the productivity of the land and for healing and for, you know, all of the different things you might need to pray for wisdom, for health, for, you know, for peace, for justice, for trying to think, for forgiveness. That's like we have a daily prayer that's a 19 blessing long prayer. But like crucially for this conversation, you turn, you face east, and you articulate all of these, you know, commitments, aspirations, hopes, among them being like an eventual return to the land. Now, for the most part, for Jewish history, Jews assumed we were exiled from the land for our sins. This is like in the Jewish liturgy is a line that says we were exiled for our sins, and we will be brought back when the Messiah comes. Basically, like the hope for the messianic era is, you know, all of those things are bound up together. And so Jews, no matter how persecuted they might have been in whatever lands they lived, didn't leave for the most part. First of all, some Jews stayed in the land. They never left the land of Israel. But all over the world, many Jews, no matter what kind of pogroms or crusades were happening, they did not pick up their communities and go back to the land of Israel because they were waiting on the Messiah. And
The time
around
wasn't right.
the time wasn't right. That's right. And so it became like the mid and late 1800s in Europe, And things were just like getting worse for Jewish people. Like even as, you know, countries like France and Germany were in theory emancipating their Jewish populations, giving them rights, letting them be citizens, they were still throwing Jews in prison for crimes they didn't commit, kind of making examples of them. There was still kind of rampant anti-Semitism. And Theodor Herzl, who is thought of as like the father of modern Zionism, came, he was a journalist. He was not a practicing Jew. He was somebody who really believed in assimilation. And after reporting on what's called the Dreyfus Affair, a guy who kind of got framed for a crime that he didn't commit, and yet, you know, a Jewish guy who was framed for a crime he didn't commit, Theodor Herzl says, this is not, like, Jews will never be welcome in Europe, you know, and things will only continue to get worse for us here. And so kind of births the idea of, and this is, of course, against the backdrop of all of these European countries carving up the globe in kind of colonial projects, right? Yeah. Like colonial projects where, like, you know, France has no ancestral history in Algeria, for example.
Right.
But, like, the Jews have ancestral history in Israel. And so it was sort of like, you know, this is our time. This is the time for us to go home. And, you know, the only major problem, of course, is that there were also people living there. You know,
yeah,
there were there was the Palestinian people who were living there. And I think this movement of what became Zionism, you know, this movement for Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, became like a kind of rallying cry for Jews around the world. And the truth was, it didn't get too much traction until after World War II, until after the Holocaust, when it became abundantly clear to the world that the Jews weren't safe in Europe, first of all. But not only that, I mean, have you watched the documentary, Ken Burns' documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust?
No.
Oh my God. All right, so recommend to all your listeners. It's long because it's a Ken Burns documentary.
Yeah. I think I've seen like portions of it.
One of the things, he really just lays bare, and it's just so painful to watch, is Jews in Europe were trying desperately to go anywhere, to escape to any country in the world, and no country would accept them, you know, no country. And so, you know, so then 6 million Jews die, and a whole bunch of other people die too, you know, and in Nazi concentration camps. And and so it's after that that the world finally, you know, sort of says, okay, you know, okay, we'll give you Israel. And there's a, you know, a two-state partition plan. And of course, you know, like, I don't know how much of this history folks are familiar with. The, you know, Palestinians and the Arabs who are living there are like, no, what are you talking about? The whole thing used to be ours. Why, we don't want half of it. Exactly. We want the whole thing.
Yeah,
the Jews are like, we'll take anything. Thank you.
Yeah.
and then, of course, is a war. And in the war, the Jews win, and the people who live inside of what becomes the modern state of Israel are Israelis. It is a nationality of people who are citizens of the state of Israel, which includes, importantly, 20% Arabs and Palestinians.
Yeah.
You do not have to be Jewish to be Israeli.
Israel. In fact,
like, the future of Israel really depends on Israelis, you know, Jewish, Arab, Sudanese, you know, people who immigrated from different places all over the world, making home together, you know, and kind of like creating a, forging an Israeli identity that is different and distinct from any other identity. It has a language, Hebrew, you know, it has a flag. And
you can get a passport. You can get an Israeli passport, but you don't have a Jewish passport.
That's exactly right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Like once upon a time, I mean, on my grandma's passport out of Germany, I think it had a stamp that said she was Jewish. But like my passport certainly doesn't have that. You know, I don't know anybody who has Jew on their passport. There might still be countries that do that. I don't know. No. You know, but you could be Palestinian and Arab and have an Israeli passport.
Right. Yep.
So does that help? I mean, I know that was a very long answer, but
no, it's great though, because I feel like this history just isn't known. I mean, we were kind of chatting before you signed on, and I was like, you know, the more you learn, the more you realize anti-Semitism is one of the oldest forms of hate. in humanity. I mean, I've been doing a Lenten series with my congregation on what are Lutherans and why does it matter? And so a
Great.
lot of it was like Reformation history, and Martin Luther is kind of our guys, like the big reformer. And a big part of Luther's history is that he was incredibly anti-Semitic, especially at the end of his life. I mean, he literally wrote a document called The Jews and Their Lies. And so, yeah, and so I am talking to a group of, I think that day was like I had 35 people from my congregation, all very well educated. A lot of them have been Lutherans their whole life. And I said, who knew this? Like, who of you knew that Luther was actually really anti-Semitic? Not a single one of them had
Because
any
we didn't
idea.
teach that to our people,
We didn't
right?
teach it. And
We taught
so,
all the way up to the Reformation time history and then quit.
Yeah. Then we're
So.
like, oh, never mind. But then we're like, Bonhoeffer, like later on, we're like, woo. But I mean, I showed that, like, I found, pictures of old, like Nazi propaganda that used Luther's image
Oh, totally.
and used like the Luther rose. And there are a lot of people that think, the document, The Jews and Their Lies, was like a blueprint for Kristallnacht. And so I had people like practically in tears by the end of it, because they were just like, I'm like, I kind of feel bad about being Lutheran now. And I said, well, I mean, like we can wrestle with this, but I mean, but I kind of pointed out to them too the anti-Semitism we see in our gospels. Like the Jews were blamed for murdering Jesus, and so you see a lot of like the early Christian theologians kind of preaching this. And it's just like that in the Easter season is a big battle for preachers to kind of draw these lines of like, okay,
Because
biblical
the Gospel
Israel.
of John is so anti-Semitic,
Oh God,
you
it's
know,
like it's
it's
hard to read. And
disturbing.
we read
Really?
the pa yeah, we read the Passion story every Good Friday.
Well, you tell her
And
the story. Tell everybody the
oh gosh. Yeah,
story.
because all my Jewish listeners are gonna listen to this and be like, wow, what's in the Gospel
Yeah.
of John? All right,
I
tell
mean,
us, tell us.
so the Gospel of John is very, I mean, so throughout the entire description of Jesus's trial with Pontius Pilate and this and that, and the release of Barabbas versus the release of Jesus, the whole time John is describing the like murderous mob just as the Jews. And
Okay.
so
The
there's
bad people
no,
are always the
the
Jews
bad
every
people
single
are
time.
always the Jews, and
Got
Jesus
it.
was murdered by the Jews, and the Jews didn't accept Jesus as their
I
king.
thought
It was all this
Jesus
kind of
was
thing.
murdered by the Romans.
He
Yes,
was.
he
Oh, okay, but
was.
it says the Jews, but actually it was the Romans, and so
So yeah. So it
one
was
needs
a
to know that, or like one reads that in a different gospel, and so the gospels don't always agree, and you know historically it was this, even though the other one says something
Yeah,
else.
I mean, Pontius Pilate was the Roman governor, right? And so he was the Roman ruler. And the thing that you kind of had that we untangle that is kind of if a good preacher is doing this, it's helpful, is I have described Jesus's death as he was murdered by the state, essentially. So the Romans had full control over who was crucified and who wasn't.
That's right.
But in these, kind of outer areas, and Mom, you've been teaching this kind of stuff for 45 years, so jump in if you ever want to. But in these areas where there were, higher concentrations of other like local folks, they would at times kind of, very much partner with that community's leadership. And so
Got it.
we see that a lot in like the Pharisees were kind of the folks who felt very, very threatened by this Jesus movement that was coming up. And Jesus really got himself in trouble by doing two things. These were kind of the like last straw, for these leaders. He rose Lazarus from the dead. He resurrected Lazarus. So like he fully showed the divine power that he had. And so, because the big threat was, Caesar meant son of God, so these Roman Caesars saw themselves as divine. And Jesus was basically saying, no, you're not. I am. And so the resurrection of Lazarus was like A huge deal. And it happened, 2 weeks ish
At least
before.
according to the Gospel of John, that's
According
the
to the
reason
Gospel
that he
of
was
John,
arrested.
that's the reason. And then the other reason that really is more universal throughout our four Gospels is he flips the tables over in the temple, releases the sacrificial animals, and is basically like, you're turning my father's house into a marketplace kind of thing.
That's right.
And so in the story, Pilate presents two prisoners. He presents Jesus and Barabbas, who on the surface is just kind of described as this murderer. But what you find out kind of when you dig deeper in the scripture and in the studies of it, Barabbas was like one of the revolutionary leaders of this like push against Roman occupation. And so Pilate asked the crowd, do you want to release Jesus, this just like rabbi who I like? Because Pilate in his interactions with Jesus starts to kind of realize this guy's not really like a threat. Like, I don't understand why he's been arrested. And so Pilate kind of says, do you want me to release Jesus, who I think you guys really like? Or do you want me to release Barabbas, who's this like murderer and like this gross guy? And the whole crowd, the Jews, declare they want Barabbas
Got it.
released and to
Because
crucify Jesus.
there's a custom that at Passover time that they release someone like that the
The
people want,
prisoners released that the
because
people want. Yeah.
they had local Jewish, like King Herod was a local Jewish authority. So they were, it was like puppet stuff with
Sort of like
Rome.
pardoning the turkey on Thanksgiving.
Right. Yeah.
Just
But
kidding. Sort of.
no, I mean, it's like, yeah, there's a
But
pardon,
yeah.
right?
Thank you.
And so,
I mean, I
yeah.
just want to say, I mean, the parallels to the current moment also. I mean, when you were saying earlier, Pastor Mary, there are like towns all over the Southeast where like there really aren't that many Jews. Jews are a minority, many people aren't really very familiar with us as, human beings with
Right,
like flesh
exactly.
and blood, but
Yeah.
I think in many people's minds, we, the Jews, are very powerful, and we're all like the kind of conspiracy theories and stereotypes that that you were kind of referring to, maybe that originated, with Luther, but maybe actually go all the way back to the Old Testament or to the New Testament. These kind of visions of power, control, authority, influence. The Jews are very persistent, and so it's like, well, they may not be in your town, but they're everywhere,
Yeah, well, I mean, you guys have the space lasers, so I mean, we
Don't
just
say that to your listeners who don't know that we don't. Like, I don't have a space laser. I can't even get solar panels on my house.
Oh, man.
I do want to say, so I had a conversation with a black pastor. It happened to be like the day after the inauguration, when Elon Musk did his little like thing where he hit his chest and then stuck his hand in the air at a 45-degree angle, which like in no universe is putting your hand in the air at a 45-degree angle anything other than a reference to a Nazi salute. Okay, come on,
Exactly,
guys. Like,
yeah.
come on. And so this pastor said to me, he said, do the Jews have any self-respect? Like, why are the Jews not up in arms? Like, why are the
Awful.
Jews not saying anything?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, who are the Jews? In my
Right.
circles, like
Yeah.
on my rabbinic listservs in my community, among the Jews that I know, all of us were up in arms
We're
about
all
it.
up in arms.
However, some of the large organizations that claim to speak on behalf of the Jewish community, that in fact don't represent everybody, but do in some cases hold seats of power and or hold, seats of visibility, and have a lot of Twitter followers or something. And they were being, even people who, claim to speak for in Jewish interest and saying, hey, let's actually just like give Elon the benefit of the doubt here, And so people think that's the Jews. It's
Right.
not, of
Yeah.
course it's not. And in no community do you have, one person who speaks on behalf of everybody with that identity. Are you kidding?
Right.
Like the
Yeah.
Muslims, the Christians? No, we all
Yeah.
know. The blacks, the whites, like no, there
Right.
are,
Yeah.
and it's not the same for the Jews
Well,
either. But to hear that about Jesus's time, of course there were people who were collaborating with the Romans. And of
Yeah, of
course
course there
there
were,
were
because there
people who
always
were
are that.
resisting. Right. Of course, there were people who were resisting as well that were also Jews. So,
yeah.
You know,
well, and
I
that's the
know.
interesting
To
thing,
that.
too. I mean, so like what I love to do, whether I'm teaching Bible study or preaching, is I'm a big, big fan of historical context. And
Yeah.
so, you know, one of the, there's this really phenomenal book, which all of our regular listeners are gonna be like, my God, she talks about this book all the time, but it's called The Book of Longings by Sue Monk Kidd. And she tells the Jesus story through the lens of if he had gotten married. And it tells it through the lens of his wife, who happens to be the stepsister of Judas Iscariot, who is the betrayer of Jesus, turns him over for, you know, whatever. And, but my favorite kind of twist on the story that, that Sue Monk Kidd does is, you know, she changes the reasoning why, or like she gives a reason to Judas's betrayal. So for a lot of people and what we're taught in Sunday school and this and that is that Judas was just really greedy and he turned Jesus over for 30 pieces of silver and he was happy about it. And he went away cackling as Jesus died. Right. Like it's kind of the picture that's painted for us.
Okay.
But what I find interesting is as you kind of research it, you realize that's not necessarily the case. And the way Sue Monk Kidd points it is Judas was actually the most radical revolutionary among the group of disciples and really saw Jesus as this kind of, you know, potentially militaristic leader that was going to destroy the Romans, bring the Jewish people back up where they belonged, reclaim Jerusalem, you know, all these kind of things. And then Jesus ended up being this homeless rabbi that preached love and forgiveness.
Wow.
And so in this novel,
they were disappointed.
They were disappointed. And in this novel, you know, Sue Monk Kidd basically paints Judas as this character that says, you know how I might be able to get him to do this is if we turn him into a martyr. If we turn him into a martyr, the revolution will happen and like all will be right with the world. And so I just think it's so like all of the history of, you know, the Babylonians and then this and then that. I mean, that all feeds into even our Christian texts and, you know, all these different things that kind of lead to our mentalities and kind of lead to the mentalities of the people who were writing these stories down.
Right.
And so I think, you know, the history that you gave was great because so many people, even just when they're trying to figure out their own scriptures, don't know those histories as well as they should. I mean, my Old Testament education at seminary was not good. So I actually started going with Ari to Torah study because I was like, I'm going to the source because I'm not getting it here. And so I would ride the train up and we went a couple times and it was great. I loved it. But, so it's, you know, kind of learning that background is so important.
And now I want to like take it back to Pastor Mary's question from whatever it was half an hour ago, where it's
right.
What happened on October 7th to the Jewish community. And, you know, and by the way, you know, just like Jews are not all of one mind. Israelis are also not all of one mind. I was just listening today to an interview with an Israeli law professor who is like very left wing. And she was one of the people who was writing some of the counter legislation in, you know, the summer of 2023, as there was like a whole judicial reform movement happening in Israel. This is before October 7th. This is, you know, where Netanyahu's very, very right-wing government, you could say like extremist, messianic military, you know, militant right-wing government was trying to push through judicial reforms. So this particular professor was, you know, doing some of the arguing and counter legislating against that. She was saying she came to America to do like a, you know, a fellowship at the University of Chicago, and people were putting up like, don't go to this Zionist professor's classes. She's a Zionist oppressor. She's, you know, and she's like, oh my God, I'm like the person who's like the furthest to the left in my country. And then I come here and you see me and you hear that I'm Israeli and I'm like the Zionist oppressor. And I think that, you know, I don't spend too much time on TikTok or in like the deep recesses of the web, but I think that certain words and identities have been hijacked by people who use those words in really like insulting ways that paint everyone with any relationship to that thing as the worst version of that thing, you know? Right. So I don't know if, you know, Timothy McVeigh would think of himself as like a patriotic American, but like, right-wing nationalistic terrorism in this country is not how I think of myself as an American.
Right. Yeah.
And the same is true, obviously, with Israelis. You have had Israelis who were, you know, first, well, so let's now, go back to before October 7th, you know, the Israel's existed for about 75 years, 1948, and came into being around the same time as many countries in the world were coming into being, you know, as the UN was being created and the maps of the world was, you know, were being redrawn after World War II. And the question of, so after the 1948 war, what Israel refers to as the War of Independence and Palestinians refer to as the Nakba, the catastrophe, right? They lost that war. And in losing it, they became refugees. They became a refugee people. Many that moved to Jordan or to Syria or Lebanon or Egypt or Gaza. And then some who left the area altogether. And, you know, so a friend of mine here in Chicago, you know, was a descendant of Palestinian refugees, just like my grandparents at around the same time are German refugees, you know.
Right, yeah.
There were refugees created all over the world. And right now still, you know, unfortunately, it's, you know, it is very much like it's the story of humanity. And so, you know, starting in 1948, there became like a question of, so are these neighboring countries going to absorb Palestinians? Palestinians remained refugees. And just like Jews for 2,000 years kept looking at their homeland saying, one day we'll return. Palestinians felt the same thing, you know, one day we'll return. And so in 1967, you know, there have been different wars and skirmishes throughout. But in 1967, Israel had like a decisive victory over, you know, the neighboring armies that kind of all came in at once. And Israel, you know, reclaimed, like, or not reclaimed, but like took control over a large part of Egypt and Jordan and the, you know, Golan Heights in Syria. And at that point had land to negotiate for peace. And that, you know, so over the course of time, Israel negotiated back this enormous section of Egypt for peace with Egypt. And now Israel has peace with Egypt. And you can, you know, when I was living there in my year in rabbinical school, I crossed the border into Egypt and traveled. And, you know, I had the American passport, but I was clearly coming in from Israel, you know, traveling with a Jewish group. And fine, money is money. Tourists are tourists. Like, it was you know, not a problem. Did the same thing in Jordan, because eventually Israel was able to come to a peace with Jordan, you know. And so, and you have like these agreements that have been arrived at over time. And the idea, I think, in theory, based on the Oslo process, which this is like now we're talking about the 1990s and a very hopeful time in history when Palestinians and Israelis actually believed the Palestinians could have a state alongside Israel that that was comprised of Gaza and the West Bank. And, you know, it depends on who you talk to, on who blames who for the breakdown of Oslo. I think, you know, many Palestinians will blame the Israeli settlement movement for continuing to develop settlements in the place that was supposed to be their future state, and no Israeli government really reining in that process. And the Israelis will blame Palestinian terrorism. You know, they started coming in here and blowing up buses and killing our children and showing up at Passover Seders and blowing up Seders. And, you know, like, you showed us that you don't want peace. And I think probably at the end of the day, extremists on both sides really work together to crush the possibility of there being two states living side by side next to each other. And over the course of the last couple of decades, you know, the quality of life in Israel continued to, you know, continue to go up. The tech boom happened. Like, Israel is becoming more and more of a Western nation. And Palestinians, in the meantime, are living under occupation. They're living under Israeli occupation in the lands conquered in 1967, you know, without, you know, national statehood. Like, sir, they're not citizens of the state of Israel, but there's also no country called Palestine, you know? And so in the meantime, they're living under Israeli military occupation, and life under occupation got worse and worse. Like, and settlements continued to expand. And I think as the, you know, as time moves forward and Israel's like making peace with different Arab neighbors, the Abraham Accords happen under President Trump, and it really looks like Israel is becoming kind of a well-accepted member of the Middle East, you know, the community of nations in the Middle East. And, you know, and Hamas's leadership, like a basically like a internationally recognized terrorist organization that had taken leadership in, I think, 2005 in Gaza, planned this attack that, you know, we all know very well now, that happened on October 7th and woke up Jews at 6:30 in the morning when they came in by air and parachutes and sea by boats and, you know, blew through fences, you know, in tanks and jeeps, and came and started killing people, you know, killing and raping and then taking people hostage. And that moment completely, I mean, it polarized the world. And, you know, I would say immediately in the aftermath, I think actually like the Israeli public and the overwhelming number of Jews in the world felt like Israel had a right to, first of all, secure its borders and defend itself. And then I think after that point, you know, is where you get like the real debate about, well, what does it mean? You know, like the Israeli government continues to say, to get the hostages back, we have to defeat Hamas once and for all, and that's why we're still fighting this war. Most Israelis at this point don't believe that. Most Israelis at this point are sick of fighting this war and don't want to be fighting this war, and
They
their
have to
government
be.
is, you know, their government is kind of like pushing them into it. And there's an increasing number of young Israeli soldiers who are, you know, resisting the draft. Like, they don't want to go. They don't. And serving in the IDF for Israelis, for certainly for Jewish Israelis, but for Druze Israelis, and you know, it's a big honor, you know, to be defending your tiny little country in the midst of, you know, hostile enemies. But now, I think people feel very conflicted about it. And you have and Jews all over the world that really like support the existence of a Jewish state and want it to exist, and also don't want it to exist at the expense of the rights of Palestinians or at the rights of anybody. God forbid, you know, that like you should be, people should have to be murdered in order for us to, you know, exist in the Middle East, in, you know, our ancestral homeland. So I think there's debate about what does it take? Like, what would it take for Jews to be able to thrive, you know, and just live peacefully in this little slice of land, and also the other native people of that land to live peacefully and thrive there. And you get people with very different ideas of what that takes, what that would take.
It's
And
so
yeah.
complicated. It's just so complicated.
I mean, it is, and I think, you know, like again, it depends on who you talk to. So I'm in a fellowship right now with a bunch of rabbis, and one of the things that we're doing is kind of talking about, you know, how we as a Jewish community have respectful but honest discourse about, you know, about all this, recognizing the different stakeholders. And so it's like there are people who think that the solution is one state, right? One state. But it depends on who you talk to, what that one state looks like. Because, right, Hamas thinks it should be one state, like one Islamic Republic that's Judenrein, like where there are no Jews between the river and the sea. There are right-wing Israeli settlers right now who very much also want it to be one state in which Jews have rights that other people don't have. You know, so there are two versions of two kind of messianic extreme versions of one state where the other people don't have rights. And then there's the version of one state that, you know, when I talk to people who identify themselves as anti-Zionists in America, like the people who are part of my community who might refer to themselves that way, they aren't talking about either of those versions of one state. They're imagining a state that aspires to be something like the United States, you know? Everybody has a vote. Everybody has rights. Nobody has rights that are different from anybody else's rights. We recognize the traumas of both people in the past, and You know, and that's how we build a collective future together, where
Yeah.
everybody recognizes the traumas they've caused to the other, and we move forward, you know, with rights for everybody, which sounds really good, except for like it kind of strips both Jews and Palestinians of their right to determine their own fate, you know, their right to self-determination. So then you get people who are like, two states is the solution. You know, two states is both the moral solution and the strategic solution. And you know, and while we're sitting around having this as a conversation, like yesterday, the Israeli Knesset just approved more settlement building in a section of the West Bank that will take up even more space
Oh,
that
gosh.
was designated to be part of Palestine. So you have, you know, American, you know, people who are center, center left, even center right, who are sitting around talking about two states, while the Israeli government is pushing forward into, you know, making that really like hard to imagine, you know, harder and harder to imagine. So, you know,
given, you know, given all of that, what in your synagogue, what do you pray for in all
Oh,
of
that's
that? How do
beautiful.
you express it?
Well, for the longest time, you know, we would just express the deep yearning and desire for Israelis and Palestinians to recognize each other's humanity, you know, and for all of us to recognize and affirm the humanity of others, and especially others that we may have a hard time living with, but ultimately we must recognize as our brothers and sisters if we are going to make peace, you know, and we are going to live in peace. And so the sermons that we gave and the prayers that we said, you know, we're aspiring toward that. And so it wasn't like prayers that aspire toward a certain political outcome, but more of like the prayer that people can heal within themselves enough not to operate from a place of fear, not to make decisions from a place of trauma and reactivity, but from a place of vision, you know, to be able to imagine their own grandchildren living in peace and then take the steps necessary to work toward that, rather than, you know, rather than building walls, but actually like deconstructing walls in order to be able to see the other. All of that sounds really beautiful. I have to tell you, like when I'm with, you know, when I go to Jerusalem and I study, you know, with rabbinic colleagues who live there, they say like, it's easy for you to say. Easy for you to say when you don't have to run to a bomb shelter every time there's a siren, when the Houthis from Yemen or Hamas is like shooting a missile, that, you know, we need to like grab our children and run into a bomb shelter. And, you know, and to which I would say, like, all the more reason to emphasize a diplomatic solution that makes, you know, that reality go away, you know, that you actually talk out a solution to that reality. You know, there are different values that people are operating by, you know, privileging in the hierarchy of values. So it's like me and that person, like that person, their top priority value might be self-preservation. In that moment, it is not peace. It's not justice. It's not compromise. These are all Jewish values. They're Jewish values that I hierarchize, you know, like I hierarchize peace and compromise and justice and, you know, and self-preservation. And then like, there's also, you know, you open up the Torah, there's the land, the holiness of the land and the relationship and the mitzvah to settle the land. Like, where does that fit in the hierarchy? And so me and like the right-wing extremist messianic Jews, Israelis, over there, I'm like, for your listeners, I'm like pointing over there, you know, you know, like we are reading the same Torah, but they're reading the verses about the imperative to settle the land as imperative number one, as value number one. And I am not. For me, that's the value, like that's at the bottom of the hierarchy.
Well, it's interesting
God
too.
Loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself has to be way up here.
So then tell me, why are Christians funding the settlement movement?
So I was just about to start. So as like,
help me understand.
Like, I know. Well, we are trying to figure that out too. So it's interesting because as Christians kind of looking in on this like very historical, very kind of ancient debate. I mean, we can go into like crusade history where the Christians are like, actually, we'd like this place. I mean,
That's
just
right.
walk away. But there's a debate within Christianity as well of kind of who do we side with here? And the mainline Protestant traditions typically, like I know mom had members of her congregation in the 90s who were constantly like, we have to pray for Palestine. We have to, push
They were helping to
for these
build the university
agreements.
over there in
Yep, doing all these
Bethlehem.
things. And, I think, but then there's the kind of like evangelical Christianity that says, well, God's chosen people is Israel. And so, and that's where like we were talking about kind of folks who can't quite draw the line between Israelis and Jews is we talk a lot, I talk a lot in breaking down what is the biblical Israel and what is like the current state, the nation of Israel, and kind of defining that difference. And there's just a lot of places that just decide not to define that difference and have their own amounts of Islamophobia that they're dealing with and things like that. And that's like the Christian nationalism that we get into. But I will say, like, even in for Southwest Virginia, a pretty moderate congregation, when we pray for peace, and I, like after, like when the, ceasefire was broken and like 400 Palestinians were killed in like the first hour and things like that, I always do make sure because I want peace for both places, we pay for, I never say, I say Palestine and Israel, like in the same
And I don't know
petition.
how that strikes the Jewish community, but
Right. And so it's just like it's one of those things where I'm actually working with there's a peace in Palestine kind of subgroup of Christians. Well, no, it's Appalachian Peace and Education Center, which is kind of the Democrats of this area. And there's a little subgroup that's very pro-Palestine and taught trying to figure out ways in which we as Christians can help tell the story, the entire encompassing story of what's going on and the two-state solution and these kind of things. And because there's so many people that just don't know how it all even started. And it's we always just say, well, it's just such a complicated thing and there's so much history to it. So like, whatever. But one of our goals is to create a Bible study of sorts slash like program on kind of looking at the entire kind of biblical story, but then also kind of redefining these words. And one of the guys that does it, he has already written a big section of it, but it's particularly to evangelical Christians, and kind of how to kind of tease apart some of this old thinking. And I mean, I'll never forget, I worked in Atlanta before I went to seminary and I was a teacher. And there was a woman who was one of the assistant principals, Black woman, very democratic in a lot of ways. And it was Trump's first election in 2016. And she just posted this huge thing on Facebook one day about how she doesn't agree with anything he does and all this kind of thing, but he supports Israel. And God said, we support Israel. So she was voting for him.
I mean, the single issue voters who are voting on, Trump being quote good for Israel, and therefore I find it very scary whether they are evangelical Christians who are banking on him helping facilitate the second coming. Because obviously, like, I'm pretty sure that means a bunch of Jews return there and then are burned up in like a fiery hellscape of, non-belief or something.
No doubt.
It's like, I don't know why, I think the Jews who get on board with that are doing it, from a place of skillful, it's like from a place of, well, we don't believe that's going to happen. And in the meantime, they're being useful to us. Ha ha, jokes on them, and in all cases, it's completely dismissing the presence of the Palestinian people who are there, who, who have just been kind of like everybody's football, or like just like a hot potato, kind of getting like kicked around as a strategy point. And it's like, it's not fair to them. They don't have good leadership either. That's,
And
so
people who think Hamas is the lead, like are the leaders of Palestine, it's
right.
like,
Like they're the righteous, like they're the righteous resistance. No, and I think you saw that recently
Well,
with.
and So we're gonna thank you for being here today, and we'll probably need to have you back
I
if
was
you're
gonna
okay.
say, yeah, this might need to be a
This
two-parter.
might happen, which is fine. We could totally schedule that. I mean,
I
obviously,
know.
like, it's just
Let's do
talking
it.
shop, you know? It's like,
Right,
it's so fun to sit
exactly.
around and talk about the thing that's your thing with people who are interested in your thing and have their relationship, you know, because they're doing their thing and it's kind of the same, but also different. And let's talk about it.
Right, it's
Really
awesome. I
fun.
love it.
It's great. Well, listen, thank you so much for everything, and we look forward to having you back. But we do want to come to MishCon the next time we're in Love to have you.
Chicago. All right.
Yes.
Thank you
All
so
right.
much.
Thank
Love
you
to
so
have
much,
you.
Rabbi
Take care.
Lizzie.
Thank you so much. This was very fun. You know.
Absolutely. It really
See you
was.
soon.
All right. Have a great day.
Bye.
Bye.